October 22 is a very significant day in the history of our beginnings.
All right, welcome back to the Avenus History Podcast. This episode is called Desmond Ford, Part 2. Just to recap, last time we were introduced to Desmond Ford, surprise, the prodigy of the Australasian Missionary College, of course now it's Avondale University. Ford emerged from Avondale, spent several years as an evangelist and pastor throughout the 1950s, and then we ended last month's episode by talking about Robert Grave, the North New Zealand Conference president, who landed in hot water for espousing things like the unfallen nature of Christ. Ideas he knew were shared by many of the brethren in America, but which were still very controversial in the South Pacific. Des wrote to his old professors at Avondale for help. He wrote to people in America for help, seeking their expert counsel about questions of the sanctuary doctrine, including the investigative judgment, but also about the Grave affair. Des had insisted that if the 2,300-day prophecy of Daniel 8:14 proved false, at least as far as Avenus interpreted it, then Adventism had no reason for being. Some of his old professors confessed that the argument for this traditional Adventist interpretation was unsupportable in their opinion. All right, so that's our recap of the last episode. Let's continue on with Des's life. We are going to make some amazing progress in this episode. This is all our run-up to Glacier View in 1980. That's what all this is about. So if you're sitting there thinking, didn't we cover the 1950s? We did. We did cover the 1950s. But we're backing up. We're talking about Desmond Ford and trying to give some context to Glacier View, which we will get to someday. Someday. Anyways, I thought we were going to make a lot more progress in this episode. Turns out we're going to go move about 3 years, 4 years. We're going to barely cross the threshold and get to the 1960s. So you are forewarned. This may go a little deeper than you were expecting. And if that gets you excited, you're my kind of person. Anyways, after graduating from Avondale in 1850. Already made a mistake, Matthew. Anyways, he graduated in 1950. He lived a long life. We talked about that in the last episode. Didn't live that long of a life. Anyways, Des felt destined for further education. In fact, from the very beginning, he was marked by the Adventists who were in his life. He was marked as somebody who was destined to get more of an education than a simple unaccredited ministerial education at Avondale, which is what it was in those days. It was unaccredited, and so when he graduated, he was only suited for the Adventist ministry. He and his wife, Gwen, moved from town to town throughout the 1950s. We talked about that last time. He did evangelism. He spoke at various events, had a debate, pastored local churches. But Des and Gwen never spent much money on furnishing a house because they felt that they might be called to attend the seminary in America at any time. So they didn't want to put down deep roots in Australia because they thought at any minute we could be told that we have the green light to head to America and go to seminary. When Des and Gwen attended a workers' meeting about 1956 or 57, they attended to hear one Roy Allen Anderson preach. We've talked about Roy Allen Anderson before. He was an Aussie native now working up in the high rafters at the General Conference, and he had come back to preach for a workers' meeting. And while there, Des began to get dizzy and fainted. An Adventist doctor, who was the doctor, on call for that event, roused Des, woke him up, and then berated him. Quote, "Don't you believe in the health message?" End quote. I'm sorry, I should issue a trigger warning on this, because if you're an Adventist who's listening to this and you feel like this is the most Adventist thing to do in this situation, somebody faints, and then you rouse them and immediately berate them because they're not, you don't know anything about them, but it must be their fault that they fainted. They must be eating wrong. They must not be exercising enough. They're not doing what they ought to be doing. If that's like the first assumption you have, that is, oh man, you are home in the Adventist church. Anyways, Dez is obviously still coming too. He muttered that I do believe in the health message, but the doctor kept interrogating him. Well, what exactly are you eating? How often are you exercising? Well, Dez told him, and the doctor pronounced, "You will be finished by the age of 40 unless you change your habits." Dez did not take this very gentle advice at first, but he later came to see the wisdom of needing to make some changes in his life, concluding, quote, "We are not only sinful, but also stupid," end quote. I feel like I got a new motto for my life. I could put that, I love that one. Anyways, in 1957, after Dez's debate with the Church of Christ pastor that we talked about last time, the call finally came. He was going to go to the seminary, but Dez couldn't go to the seminary and get a master's degree without first having a bachelor's degree, because remember, when he graduated in 1950, he did not get an accredited degree. So he had to go back to Avondale for 1 year to complete his BA. Unfortunately, Dez's health problems persisted, so he did take up jogging, and that's the unfortunate part. Something he would do religiously for the next 50 years. Personally, I hate jogging, but kudos to him for picking up a great health practice and continuing it for half a century. Dez was still wrestling with the issues that were kicked up by the grave affair when he got to Avondale. He didn't believe that the traditional Adventist view in Daniel 8:14 was defensible. This is something we talked about last time that he gleaned from his first stint at Avondale, but also from the professors and other thought leaders that he wrote to during the 1950s. And the reason why I want to hammer this home in the last episode and then remind you of it right now is because people get the idea that Dez just invented this. That at some point, Desmond Ford gets up and he just wants to challenge the sanctuary. Dez was, of course, his own man. You know, he had his own thoughts, but this was in the air all around Dez. This was at his school when he wrote to leaders in the United States. You know, some of them were sharing that they no longer believe in it either. He was not the one who started this idea, right? And that's something that's worth keeping in mind as we go through his story. But anyways, so yes, he didn't believe in the traditional view, the traditional Adventist view of Daniel 8:14, but he also had no real temptation to follow Grave himself in his protest against the Adventist church. For as Dez put it, quote, "It was just so angry with the church and spoke so badly about the leaders." But he was correct in what he was saying about the nature of Christ, and he was correct in what he was saying about the sanctuary, and later I would come to echo many of the things he was saying, end quote. Robert Grave had visited Dez, probably or possibly hoping to see if there was any affinity there, like, are we on the same team? But before long, he wrote Dez off. Grave's interest in Dez would return, however, when he heard about Glacier View 25 years later. Why didn't Dez think the traditional Adventist interpretation of Daniel 8:14 was defensible? Well, to put it briefly, and this is something I really struggled with, because this is not, as I've said many times, a History of Adventist Theology podcast. And so I endeavor to only explain theology when it helps you understand the decisions and actions and words of various people in Adventist history. This is one of those issues, however. The sanctuary is, I don't want to say it's complicated Adventist theology, but it is not something that people can intuitively grasp. I think people can intuitively grasp the concept of Sabbath, even if you don't agree with it. You don't need a Bible study to understand what Sabbath is all about. You can just explain it very simply. But the sanctuary message, including the investigative judgment, all of that, all of these issues, the sanctuary message is a kind of a coalition of different issues, including the investigative judgment. And, you know, if you don't know what they are, it feels like it would take a whole episode to explain it. So if you don't really understand it, even after I give you a brief explanation here, please Google it. It will really help you understand the characters in this. I've thought about, do I want to put out a blog post or a bonus episode or something explaining this theology? And perhaps I will. But in the meantime, go right ahead and educate yourself. I'll do my best here with a one paragraph explanation of it, okay? And that's this, the traditional or a traditional Adventist interpretation. And that was that Daniel 8:14 speaks about 2,300 days and then the sanctuary will be cleansed. Adventists understood these days as equaling years, which means that this investigative judgment, this cleansing of the sanctuary, that's how they interpret that. The sanctuary is going to be cleansed what? Of sin. And in order for it to be cleansed of sin, there needs to be some kind of investigative judgment, some kind of looking into where do these sins belong? Who is righteous? Who has the righteousness of Christ? Who has spurned God? Right? Figuring out where does everybody stand in the world, and particularly among the people of God. And so anyways, this investigative judgment, Adventist belief, began in 1844 on October 22. That's when Jesus moved his ministry from the holy place in the heavenly temple to the most holy place in the heavenly temple, signifying a shift in what he was doing in the focus of his ministry. God raised Adventists up in 1844 to warn the world of this judgment, call the world to repent and return to God. During this judgment, your name could appear at any moment in the courts of heaven, and your eternal fate would be sealed when that moment comes, I guess. Uriah Smith captured the implications of the sanctuary message. Why do Adventists talk about this so much? Well, Uriah Smith, one of our pioneers, wrote, quote, "Reader, do you now see the importance of this subject? Do you see that the whole work of salvation centers there, and that when the work is done, probation is ended, and the cases of the saved and lost are eternally decided?" End quote. So, for Adventists, there is a great urgency. And I think if you didn't grow up, even if you grew up Adventist, if you didn't grow up with this traditional view of the sanctuary, I hope you can appreciate how gripping it is, how insistent it is, how urgent it is, because what it's really saying is you need to be ready, not for the signs of the times and Jesus to come in the clouds of glory. I mean, yes, for that, but because you need to make sure you're right with God right now, because the judgment's going on right now. Now is the time to get right with God. Now is the time to go talk to your neighbor and make sure they're right with God, because the judgment's going on right now. And, this is not bad news. This is good news. It means the end is finally here, and we need to wake up to what time it is. You get the idea, right? It's very urgent. It does make you feel a sense of awe and respect and reverence for God and what he's doing, and it makes you feel like you know something most Christians don't know, because they're still like talking about the cross, and we're like, hey, we're much closer to the second coming than that. There's other things we need to be aware of too. Anyways, you get the idea of it, right? This or some slight variation of it is what the Adventist Church has taught at various levels around the world for most of its history. Dez, of course, did not grow up with this traditional view, but he was determined to defend the church's teaching as best as he could. And he had never been sold on it. Why? For several reasons. First, he thought Daniel 9 was clear as day evidence that the Day of Atonement pointed first and foremost to the cross and only to an investigative judgment as a secondary meaning. Second, Desmond Ford saw that many Adventists didn't seem to have the assurance of their salvation. And how could they, right? If they were constantly wondering when their name would come up in the judgment. It was as though, Jesus had never died on the cross for people's sins, because if you're still sitting around wondering whether or not you're going to make it through the judgment, then what was the point, right? I mean, if there's no assurance, what was the point of the cross? What's the point of faith if it doesn't bring assurance? Third, Des resisted what we would today call last generation theology, this particular strain of perfectionism, and I'm going to put that in quotes, where a final generation would be able to stand without a mediator. He believed that we would always be wrestling with sins and confessing sins until Jesus returned. And so he never bought into the perfectionism that often associated itself with the sanctuary message, right? Because God's people need to be holy. We need to be pure so we can stand before God, you know. Anyways, you can see how that could lead to perfectionistic impulses. So anyways, these are three reasons why Dez never really bought into the traditional view. And we have to keep in mind also, Dez's theology does, he is pretty consistent over the course of his life, to be sure, but he does mature. He does change. At some point, he's not going to even defend 1844, but here, you know, he still thought 1844, still taught that 1844 was significant, just didn't teach the sanctuary in the way traditional Adventists would understand it. Now, on this last point, this point about perfectionism, Dez found trouble with a student he met at Avondale, a man named Robert Brinsmead. You may have heard of him. Dez found Bob Brinsmead to be a bright young man, very traditional Adventist who in some ways had gone to extremes. Brinsmead was proclaiming that the sanctuary to be cleansed was the human soul, not some heavenly sanctuary. The Holy Spirit would make God's people perfect. It was another notion that he was purveying. Dez and young Brinsmead predictably clashed when Dez tried to get Bob to see the problems in the traditional Adventist view of the sanctuary to no avail. Now, the same year that Dez was at Avondale, he received a letter from his old professor, Alfred Kranz. We quoted Alfred Kranz the last episode, but I don't know that I mentioned his name. Anyways, this is a couple paragraphs here that his old professor wrote him, and I think it's worth quoting in full to get an idea of the influences in Dez's life and where they were, what their convictions were. Quote, "When one grows older and faces the solemn realities of the lessening years, he is perhaps more concerned with the necessity of strict honesty before God. God forbid that I should misjudge or presume to judge others. However, one must face facts. It is as clear as daylight to me that this is what we are often not prepared to do. There can be no doubt that Sister White is unscriptural in many of her views. I could point to numerous errors in her writings and to interpretations of texts which are contradictory to sound exegesis. Even some of the things which she said she saw or was shown turn out to be incorrect. And yet our leaders in general close their eyes to these things or refuse to discuss them. Or, if they do admit them, fail to discern their import and still lead our people to rely upon them as the word of God. I do not question Sister White's honesty or sincerity. I cannot be intellectually honest and fail to see her inaccuracy. As a people, we have virtually made her writings the final word on theology and the touchstone of a person's loyalty. Consequently, we cannot make any progress in an understanding of the scripture. The passage of time is a great tester of truth. Honestly, doesn't the view of an investigative judgment going on since 1844 seem more and more questionable as the years lengthen? If the end could have occurred over 50 years ago, as Sister White says, what about the judging of the dead, which could have been finished by that time?" End quote. Now, that last line that Kranz offers us, what he's trying to get at here is a statement that Jesus could have come by now, that Ellen White makes. And Kranz is saying, well, how is that possible? Because in order for Jesus to come, the investigative judgment has to be concluded. So did Jesus just decide not to come at that point? And then what, spend more time deliberating on the investigative judgment? You know, if it could have been over then, in Ellen White's day, why is it still going on today? That's his point there. And we should understand, Kranz is not merely a loyal Adventist agonizing over this. He is, in some ways, on his way out. Okay? And Dez does not follow Kranz to the limits of what he's offering here. But certainly, there's a core sympathy. Dez understands these critiques against the sanctuary message, against the investigative judgment. And at this stage in Dez's life, he feared to abandon the traditional understanding of the sanctuary. He was torn. He saw the weakness in the Adventist argument, but he also wanted to preserve the church. He wanted to maintain the church's teaching authority. He wanted to, so he was kind of like reaching out one hand like Spider-Man and grabbing one half of the boat, and then reaching the other hand and grabbing the other half of the boat, trying to hold this thing together. Ford thought that his time at Avondale and then at the seminary would provide him with the answers he needed. Because look, like anybody in his position, if you have these theological questions, I mean, you would think that when you get to the seminary, the pinnacle of Adventist theology, you think that the people there would have the answers, right? You know how many people are wrestling with some questions, theological questions, and they go to the whatever Adventist university thinking, surely the faculty there will have the answers that I need. And if they don't, surely the theologians at the seminary will. Or, you know, you might say, well, surely the Biblical Research Institute will have the answers that I need. He's looking for those answers. Now, he spent that year at Avondale, got his degree, and was sent off to America to attend the seminary in Tacoma Park. Departing on November 28th, 1958, Des, Gwen, and their two children certainly took the scenic route. Their son Paul had a cough on the ship, and Des would get up before dawn and carry Paul up to the passenger lounge. Paul would crawl around on the floor while Des tried to read a book on systematic theology. You know, that's what I want to do at like 4 o'clock in the morning. Their daughter remembered seeing their dad on his bunk, seasick. Now at Aden in Yemen, which is one of the places they disembarked to do some brief sightseeing, which is incredible to me because at the time of recording this, no one wants to get out of a boat in Yemen. Nobody. That has never occurred to me as a tourist spot. Oh, it would be cool to see, right? There's beautiful places everywhere. Anyways, Des got out after Yemen. Des got out in Egypt as well to look around Cairo. Sitting in the back of a car with several female tourists, an Egyptian man just stuck his head inside of their car, looked at Des and said, "Rich man, three wives." Which I think I saw in an Indiana Jones movie one time. Anyways, as the other tourists looked for souvenirs in a shop, Des wandered away and realized he was lost sight of the fellow tourists. He asked some local Egyptians for advice, and then he said he did exactly the opposite of what they told him to do. And I don't know if that was by accident, or he didn't hear them or understand them, or maybe he just didn't trust that they were going to lead him in the right direction, but whatever they told him to do, he did the opposite and ended up finding his group. And of course, as you have to do, he got on a camel to go see the pyramids. They also stopped in Malta, where Des left his family behind in order to make his way through Europe over land. And by doing so, he gave himself a Reformation tour. He visited Rome, the Waldensian Valleys, Geneva, and Paris. Finally, he met up with his family in England. At Newbold College, the Fords met Robert Olson, then serving in the British Union. The Fords eventually traveled from there to New York City, aboard the RMS Saxonia, a ship that was later sold to the Soviets and made famous for the defection of the so-called Red Bikini Girl, a Ukrainian teen who slithered out of a porthole and swam to shore to claim asylum in Australia. And please don't Google Red Bikini Girl. You don't want that in your browser history. Naturally, Des was up before dawn. He found the Empire State Building within 24 hours of being in New York, quite naturally. But Des didn't have long to explore New York City before the family was shipped down to the church headquarters in Tacoma Park, just north of Washington, D.C. As Des put it, quote, "the holidaying was over," end quote. Des was being sponsored for 2 years to get his degree at Potomac University, which is the Seventh-day Adventist Church's seminary. That's what it was called at the time. And then he was supposed to return home to Avondale to teach, to take up the chairmanship of their Bible department. Now, Des wasn't impressed by all his teachers. With typical Aussie bluntness, he had told the president of the seminary that he wouldn't cross the road for some of his teachers, let alone cross the world. And as I reflect on that comment, which Des relates a few times after that incident, this is I mentioned typical Aussie bluntness, and I wonder if this is sometimes what gets him in trouble with the Americans or perhaps some other people who are not accustomed to this way of this very direct, very opinionated way of speaking. I don't think Des meant to be insulting or rude, but As if I'm just putting myself in the president of the seminary shoes. If somebody came up and said that to me, I would probably feel insulted, right? But, you know, and that's why I wonder if maybe some of this is this disagreement to come is slightly, or at least partially, some cultural misunderstandings. Now, be that as it may, that Des didn't like some of his teachers, didn't feel like they were very valuable or of high enough caliber to be teaching at the seminary. The seminary was, overall, a great experience for Des. It was there that Des met Ivan Blazin, a fellow student, future New Testament scholar, who agreed with Des that, quote, the sanctuary didn't have a leg to stand on, end quote. A professor, R.E. Losby, openly announced that W.W. Fletcher was correct, that the investigative judgment couldn't be supported apart from Daniel 8:14. Another professor, Sakai Kubo, hinted at the problems with the sanctuary in his classes. Siegfried Horn, the archaeologist, definitely saw Antiochus Epiphanes in Daniel 8. Earl Hilgert was another professor who challenged Des when Des made a case for the year-day principle in Daniel 8 and 9. Hilgert, who had studied under Karl Barth, was taking no prisoners. Here are some of just a little sampling of some of Hilgert's notes in the margins of Des's paper. No, this argument is rather irrelevant. Hardly. And then a couple more no's sprinkled throughout the paper, with exclamation points, I might add. And of course, there was Ray Cottrell. Des found that Cottrell had the same problems with the sanctuary and more besides. Des would claim that after a Sabbath morning walk together, Cottrell decided to send out a survey of Adventist Bible teachers to see where they stood on this issue. And as Cottrell reports, 27 people responded, 27 teachers who had a knowledge of Hebrew in Adventist schools were unanimous. There was no contextual or linguistic evidence for this traditional interpretation of Daniel 8:14. I'll have more to say about this poll later on down the road, but the poll seemed to confirm that among at least many of the church's institutional intellectual class, this gaping hole, this urgent problem in Adventist theology was the investigative judgment. They needed to find new biblical support for it because more and more people were realizing that the traditional arguments advanced for the investigative judgment weren't holding up in modern Bible study methods, when using modern Bible study methods. This poll that Cottrell sent out was also the catalyst for the church to form a committee on Daniel, the problems in Daniel, and sort out some of these problems. And that would run through half of the 1960s. We'll get to that next time. Ford had come to Avondale and then to the seminary looking for answers. And if these men on Mount Olympus wouldn't defend the traditional position, who could? Who could? And I'm not saying that nobody did. There certainly were people who did. And I would say most Adventists believed that in the traditional position. But how could Des personally return to Avondale and teach the traditional position, as would be expected of him? Rather depressed, Des headed home one day from the seminary and was startled to receive an impression. And he insists he's not a superstitious person. He doesn't think he's gotten visions and dreams and all that kind of stuff. But he discerned a voice in his mind saying, "It's okay. It will be all right." But Des was delighted to reconnect with the teacher he had met the year before in Australia, Edward Heppenstall. Ford took the Revelation and Inspiration and the Righteousness by Faith courses from Heppenstall, but their relationship went far beyond the classroom. On a couple of occasions, when Heppenstall traveled to lecture, he took Ford with him. On one occasion, no doubt, as they were sorting out the difficulties in Adventist theology, Heppenstall said, quote, "Des, if we had as much of Isaiah the prophet as we have of Ellen White, we would probably have some problems with Isaiah too," end quote. Now that line really struck me because I had said nearly the same thing to Peter Dixon a few months ago, had no idea I was just repeating Heppenstall and probably others as well. Ford was enrolled at Potomac University in pursuit of his B.D., his Bachelor of Divinity. Now, the Bachelor of Divinity was basically the Master's of Divinity that seminarians can get today. The name would later be changed to avoid misleading people into thinking that it was another undergraduate degree. Heppenstall wouldn't have Ford getting a BD, however. And he walked up to him and said, "Dez, every time I see you, I'm troubled." And Dez was puzzled. "Why are you troubled?" Quote, "Every time I see you, I think BDs are a dime a dozen. This boy should do a PhD. Would you be prepared if I get permission for you to go and do the classwork or at least begin it for a PhD?" End quote. Dez wasn't sure, but he told Heppenstode. I was going to edit that out, but I kind of like that. told Heppenstall to go ahead and try to get him into a PhD program. That required convincing the leaders at the Australasian division who were footing Dez's bill. Church administrators, as you can imagine, weren't keen on paying for pastors to get degrees they didn't really need. But Hep managed to convince them of the advantages of getting Dez a PhD. Well, Dez came to essentially complete a master's degree. If he was going to finish a PhD, he would have to hustle. The Australasian division may have consented to Ford getting a PhD, but he would still have 2 years to earn his master's and his doctorate. Toward that end, Edward Heppenstaller, Ted, asked Dez to guest lecture for one of his classes on the subject of the sanctuary. Dez was to describe the sanctuary problems as he saw them and give the best answers to them that he could. Dez agreed to do this if this lecture could be the topic of his master's thesis in order to speed up his studies. This was granted, and Dez graduated from the seminary in about 6 months. Now, that was remarkable, but Dez still only had 18 months left to complete his PhD. He had to look outside of the Adventist educational system for that, and the larger educational world would be less accommodating to his circumstances. One of his professors at the seminary, Winton Beaven, recommended Michigan State University to Ford. Beaven had gotten his PhD under one Kenneth Hance there, and Beaven thought Ford well suited to work under his old Dr. Vater. And so the Fords shipped off to East Lansing, Michigan. Kenneth Hance was a Christian who specialized in rhetoric, but he was also, as Dez would later say, not tied down to legalistic rules. What did that mean? Well, that meant that Hance allowed Dez to do his coursework and write his dissertation at the same time. Once again, a professor had given Dez the dispensation he needed. After his first term at Michigan State, Dez reported home, noting that the Adventist schools in Michigan were strong, the church members were lovely, and the weather was way too cold. The weather didn't slow Dez down, however, because he continued to preach at the 12 churches in the area around Lansing. In fact, the Michigan Conference president noticed Dez preaching at all of these churches in the area and sent Dez a check out of appreciation. That conference president's name, Nathaniel C. Wilson, father of Neil C. Wilson, grandfather of Ted N. C. Wilson, current General Conference president. Kenneth Hance's dispensation meant, as usual, that Dez needed to cram an incredible amount of work in order to make progress in his coursework and his dissertation at the same time. Of course, Dez pulled it off, completing his PhD in 18 months. Ford had a problem when it came to paying his remaining fees so he could graduate, because the employee at the university couldn't believe that someone who had just been there 18 months could possibly be graduating with a PhD. And so Kenneth Hance had to be called to verify that he indeed was about to graduate. While in East Lansing, Ford penned an article for Ministry, which is the magazine for clergy in the Adventist Church, about what he called a primary key to the interpretation of Daniel 8 that had been neglected by the church. Now, the editors of Ministry added a note of commendation to the article. Quote, "In many parts of the world, our men are digging deeply into the prophetic word. We present this article as a stimulus to a deeper study of some familiar prophecies," end quote. In hindsight, we can delight in the irony that the editors of Ministry pegged Dez as someone who would offer greater light on the doctrine of the sanctuary. Dez began by identifying the problem. Quote, "If Seventh-day Adventists are to maintain their traditional position regarding the latter-day application of this prophecy, every possible clue to interpretation must be studied and used," end quote. Well, of course, Dez doesn't come right out and say, "I'm doubting the traditional application of this prophecy." He's by implications, saying that the traditional position is not sustainable. Therefore, we need to find every possible clue to interpretation. Like, we got to overturn every stone in the text that we can to find some new biblical argument for supporting our traditional interpretation. Des went on to argue that Daniel 8:14 stood in light of the great controversy between good and evil, and pointed to the fact that the truth that has been cast down to the ground will be uplifted in the end. Furthermore, the, quote, cleansing of the sanctuary thus parallels the prophecies of restoration from Babylon given in the Old Testament. Both point to the ushering in of Christ's kingdom as the beauty of holiness and truth become enshrined in the Latter-day Church, end quote. By the way, a delicious detail in this issue of Ministry Magazine is that the article right before Dez's was titled, How to Differ with the Brethren and Yet Love Them. You can't make this stuff up, man. Dez's article needs to be understood in its historical context. The early 1960s were something of a second wave of a conversation between Walter Martin and the Adventists. Not a direct conversation this time, sitting across a table from each other, but in the publication of various articles responding to each other and dealing with issues raised by the other party. You see, Martin's long-awaited book, The Truth About Seventh-day Adventism, had arrived, and Adventists were keen to answer or clarify or respond to a number of things that Martin had written. Now, it's important to understand that just because Dez didn't think the investigative judgment was biblical as it was traditionally understood, nor did he believe there was a literal sanctuary building in heaven, that doesn't mean he had no use for 1844 or had nothing to do with Daniel 8:14, right? Dez would later say that he tried to preserve the significance of 1844 even in his Glacier View manuscript. Now, after graduating in December 1860 with his PhD, the Ford family headed west to Pacific Union College, where they met up with Graham Maxwell. As might be expected, Dez chatted with Graham about difficulties in Daniel 8:14 and claimed that Graham had no answers either. Sailing home, Dez encountered two members of the Adventist Reform group that had emerged out of World War I. According to Dez, quote, we argued pleasantly for the whole of the voyage, end quote. Despite that voice reassuring Dez that everything was going to be all right, he was still deeply unsettled about what he would teach when he got back to Avondale. So he decided to ask David Sibley, the conference president who had initially hired Dez out of Avondale and who had pushed for Dez to go back to Avondale to finish his degree. Sibley was now a union president, and Dez asked him how he might navigate his differences with the sanctuary message in the classroom. Would Dez have to teach what he didn't believe? Or would he teach what he did believe while accepting a paycheck from the organization that expected him to teach what they believed? You following me so far? Sibley was sympathetic to Ford's predicament. After all, Sibley had been tasked with doing damage control when W.W. Fletcher had registered his protest against the church and when he criticized the investigative judgment and all of that stuff. Sibley found that Fletcher was actually right about some things. Ford couldn't believe it. You found he was right and you are a conference president? Right? How can you get rewarded with a conference presidency if you believe Fletcher was right about some things? But Sibley's response to that was that, hey, Martin Luther, John Calvin were both wrong about things and God used them. So why couldn't he use an imperfect Adventist church too? Finally answering Dez's initial question, Sibley told him, quote, tell the boys the problems and offer them the best solutions you know, end quote. 1961, Dr. Desmond Ford was now the chair of the Bible department at Avondale. From this perch, Dez was expected to promote Adventist orthodoxy in the territory. Many of the letters arriving at his desk concerned the teachings of his former classmate, Robert Brinsmead. Some of Dez's replies on these questions were, of course, private, when people wrote to him and asked him what he thought about this or that. But he answered many of them in the pages of Signs of the Times. Many of these questions are about what you would expect, such as, can you prove the existence of God and who wrote the Gospels? Yet another asks, as to what Avenus believe about 1844. Ford could have dodged that one. He didn't have to write about it, didn't have to reply to it. Ford said very artfully, quote, Avenus do, however, believe since 1844, Christ has been engaged in the final phase of his mediatorial work, end quote. Adventists believe that. He didn't say whether they should believe that, didn't explicitly say whether he believed that. He only described what they currently believed. He also focuses on Jesus's mediation, shifting from one phase to the other in 1844. Ford didn't mention that most Adventists believe there was a literal heavenly temple, and Jesus went from one room to the other in 1844. One of Ford's points through this whole thing was there is no literal sanctuary in heaven. The movement from the holy place to the most holy place is just symbolic of a different phase, not a different location for Jesus's ministry. On a bigger literary stage, the pages of the Avenus Review, Ford defended the investigative judgment. The subtitle to his article, and I don't know whether he wrote the subtitle or not, but the subtitle read, quote, the teaching of the investigative judgment is not a face-saving device, but an integral part of the everlasting gospel, end quote. This was a clear response to the claims by Barnhouse and Martin that the investigative judgment was the greatest face-saving device in history. Face-saving in the sense that it was created and just invented to explain away the great disappointment in 1844. Why didn't Jesus come? Oh, well, he was moving from one part of the heavenly sanctuary to the other, right? Des went on, quote, the Avenist doctrine of the investigative judgment is a doctrine demanded by the analogy of Scripture, end quote. The investigative judgment isn't explicitly in Scripture, but, like the Trinity, can only be understood by adding up relevant biblical texts that each have one piece of the puzzle. In this article, Des explained that what the investigative judgment accomplished. It wasn't just to see if human beings were worthy of God, but it also reveals God as being worthy to be God. In other words, the investigative judgment was not just about whether human beings had faith or were worthy to make it or anything like that. God himself was being judged too. The investigative judgment was about God and his character, not just about you and I and our character. Now, Des had his hands full as part of the church's defense against Walter Martin on one hand and against Robert Brinsmead on the other. This, after all, was what he was trained for. Isn't this why we sent you to America? Des would later tell Heppenstall, quote, when I returned to Australia in 1961, I fought the theology of Brinsmead with much ammunition gathered from you, end quote. Heppenstall and Ford both benefited from Brinsmead's awakening movement because it gave both men some cover to teach things which the larger body of Adventists otherwise might not have accepted, such as Lewis Weir's ideas about Armageddon. For the time, however, Brinsmead was the greater danger, and anyone fighting Brinsmead was probably A-OK as far as many church members were concerned. They didn't look too closely at what people like Ford or Heppenstall were teaching. But in our next episode, dun dun dun, we'll explore how Ford and Brinsmead locked horns throughout the 1960s until Brinsmead switched positions to be closer to Ford's position. And now, without the cover of fighting Brinsmead's extreme conservatism and with the more conservative administration of Robert H. Pearson, Ford's theology would get a second look. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again soon. Hey, it's me again. If this episode didn't quench your desire for more Adventist history content, then go subscribe to Adventist History Extra. It's a private podcast that I do for those who support the Adventist History Project. You can get access to Adventist History Extra on the website, which is AdventistHistoryProject.org, or by becoming a patron at Patreon.com. Now, there's more variety at Adventist History Extra, in case you were wondering. I do some interviews. Sometimes I do bonus episodes. You know, we had a good episode here in the Adventist History Podcast, and I want to talk some more about it. Other times, I go behind the scenes at conferences I attend, like the Women in Seventh-day Adventist History Conference. What's more, just as a second announcement for you, Michael Campbell and I are leading a bus tour in October 2024. So if you want to go drive around New England a bit, see the sights and have some fun, well, you can sign up for our bus tour newsletter, once again, at AdventistHistoryProject.org. And we're going to keep you up to date there about what you need to know to go and sign up for that and all of that. So just to be very, 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 very clear, we don't have a sign up for the bus tour itself, but it's a sign up for the newsletter so you can stay informed about the bus tour, so I don't have to make announcements every single time and interrupt these episodes and all of that. That's where those announcements are going to be. So if you're interested, head on over to the website. You can sign up for the bus tour newsletter over there. Okay, I think that about does it. Thanks again for listening.